deployment of the UK forces is aimed at justifying the presence of Saudi Arabia in Al-Mara, as the regime has failed to take control of the province that has the longest coastal strip on the Arabian Sea.
The deployment of British soldiers to Al-Mara came in the wake of the attack carried out by Saudi Arabia against the Mercer Street oil tanker. Ansarullah was accused of being behind the attack, but this accusation was later denied. The presence of the British forces was planned beforehand, since Saudi Arabia has failed to control the province of Al-Mara, and many people there are against the presence of Saudi forces, and they cannot remain there for a long time, as there are capable military forces in the country.
The people of Al-Mara have repeatedly voiced protest against the presence of Saudis on their land. However, the presence of foreign forces in Yemen is not limited to the UAE, Saudi Arabia or the UK. A US plane carrying 300 American soldiers and officers, along with 12 Black Hawk helicopters, arrived in Aden in southern Yemen last month. Yemenis say the recent UK move proves that colonial ambitions by foreign powers are rising rapidly amid fragile situation in the southern and eastern areas of Yemen. They have also made it clear that they will continue fighting until all of Yemen's land is liberated and foreign forces are pushed out of the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Sudan has officially agreed to hand over ousted President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, along with other officials wanted over the Darfur conflict. The International Criminal Court chief prosecutor held talks with Sudanese officials in accelerating practical steps to hand over those wanted by the court over alleged atrocities committed in Darfur.
I am pleased to announce that the reason I was late was I was signing a memorandum of understanding with the government of Sudan that was signed by me as the prosecutor and by the Minister of Justice.
Al-Bashir is currently in Khobar prison in the Sudanese capital. He was dismissed and arrested in April 2019 following a massive popular protest movement against him. ICC Chief Prosecution Karim Khan said he will accomplish his mission in order to meet the expectations of the international community, especially with regard to Security Council resolutions to achieve justice about the victims of Darfur. Last week, the Sudanese cabinet approved Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court in what was considered as a new step towards trying al-Bashir before this international judicial body in The Hague. In 2009, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for al-Bashir, accusing him of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity during the armed conflicts in Darfur that erupted in 2003 and killed more than 300,000 people.
The Sudanese government decision to ratify the Rome Statute will make the government closer to international justice. But as observers say, it also divides the political parties in the country for and against. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
Ibrahim Raisi handed to Parliament a list of his proposed cabinet ministers a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators now have 1 week to review the credentials of Raisi's picks before an open vote of confidence session is held with the presence of the president himself to defend his nominees.
For 1 week, 13 parliament commissions will be working 3 shifts a day, where they will be host the proposed ministers, asking them about their plans and visions. 3 days after the one-week time frame is over, open sessions will be held in Parliament, where the proposed ministers will take the podium one by one to lay out their plans and take questions from lawmakers.
The list consists of 19 nominees for 19 ministerial posts. Among the proposed names are Hossein Amir Abdullahian as the new foreign minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani as the defense minister, and Ismail Khatib as the intelligence minister. Lawmakers seem to not have issues with the proposed list and have promised to be cooperative with the new administration.
There will definitely be synergy and convergence between parliament and the government. We need to work together to solve the country's economic problems. We are determined to remove the illegal sanction imposed on the nation, so lawmakers and the new administration must join hands to achieve this goal.
Ibrahim Raisi won the June 18th election by landslide, securing 64% of the vote. He was sworn in on August 4th, 2 days after he was officially endorsed by Iran's leader. Raisi had 2 weeks to introduce his proposed cabinet lineup, but he released the list a week ahead of the deadline. Parliament says it will be swift to review the nominated ministers in order to speed up the formation of the new cabinet.
If all goes as planned, open floor vote of confidence sessions will be held after the week-long deliberations over the credentials of the proposed ministers will conclude behind closed doors. Given the close ties between the Iranian parliament and the new government, lawmakers expect that the vote of confidence process will wrap up in a matter of 3 work shifts. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an attempt to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is pushing through plans for more than 2,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank, and at the same time has decided, after long years, to grant a rare authorization for 836 Palestinian homes in Area C of the occupied West Bank. It's virtually impossible for Palestinians to get construction permits from Israeli authorities. Palestinians say Bennett is trying to deceive the world by the so-called equalization.
All this announcement is just to tell a fake message to the world that we are equalizing. So we give the Palestinian permissions. It's not true that we are destroying. This is like a wrong message that will be given to the international community. We should confront it as a Palestinian, and also international community should also confront that. This is a Palestinian occupied land, and Israel don't have the right either to build the settlements or to give the Palestinians in their homeland a permission to build their houses.
Under the interim Oslo Agreement signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Israeli regime in 1993, the West Bank was divided into 3 areas: Area A under Palestinian control, Area B under Palestinian and Israeli control, and Area C under full Israeli control, and this comprises some 60% of the occupied West Bank. Israel prevents Palestinians from constructing private or public buildings in Area C under different pretexts, such as using the land as military training zone or it locates close to settlements and other claims.
Israel is controlling Palestinians' lives in these areas. It prevents them from constructing new homes in their own lands. The new move is aimed at covering up Israel's future plans for new settlement projects in the Palestinian lands.
At the end of the day, it's almost impossible for Palestinians in Area C to get Israeli-issued building permits. Moreover, Israeli forces on a daily basis destroy and demolish Palestinian structures in the same area for lack of construction authorization, despite the policy deemed illegal by the international community.
Palestinians don't take Israel's new move seriously, saying what matters for Tel Aviv is to execute its plan known as the Classified C Areas, which is aimed at putting an end to the presence of Palestinians on the mentioned areas. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
To show its goodwill to find a peaceful solution to the years-long crisis in Yemen, Yemen's Ansarullah has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the current crisis.
The initiative put forward by the Ansarullah leader serves the interests of all Yemeni people. I believe it is an appropriate opportunity for all conflicting sides to get out of the current predicament and avoid military battles. With this initiative, Ansarullah reaffirms once again that it is keen on finding a political solution to the conflicts in Yemen.
The spokesman of Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdus Salam, said the initiative includes stopping the Yemeni army's operations in Marib, reactivating the Marib gas station to generate electricity for all Yemen, and forming a joint administration from the people of Marib to maintain security and expel the terrorist groups from the city.
The initiative launched by Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi's aim to stop war in Marib. The people of Marib should have the final say when it comes to their political fate. Meanwhile, the roads must be open for the free movement of Yemenis. This initiative is an appropriate measure that will benefit the Yemeni people and establish a comprehensive political and economic solution to the current crisis.
The free movement of all Yemenis, Abdus Salam said, should be guaranteed, as well as the release of all the detainees from the prisons of the Saudi-backed forces in Marib. Ansarullah's initiative came in conjunction with the UN's appointment of Hans Grundberg of Sweden as its new envoy for Yemen.
Maliki said changing the UN envoy will not solve the problem because, as things stand, this is the US which controls the situation and leads the war on Yemen behind the scene. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of thousands of local Afghans have fled their cities and villages in northern and northeastern provinces due to back-to-back collapse of most provincial capitals in the north and northeast to Taliban. Some displaced families have arrived in the capital, Kabul, and they have nowhere to go but the roadside or parks like the one here in central Kabul. That is why they welcome any move that could mitigate their misery. The advances have displaced more families across the country. Some displaced people accuse local officials of making secret deals with Taliban.
Our city fell to Taliban without any exchange of fire. The same story went on in Ghazni city, where its governor was arrested by the NDS over handing over the city to Taliban. This proves that there are some secret deals behind the collapse of our cities.
The displaced Afghans urge warring sides to stop turning more cities into the battlefields by resuming a meaningful intra-Afghan negotiation.
We, the people of Afghanistan, are the main victims of war. We have lost all we had. Ceasefire is the only way to get out of the current crisis. The government and Taliban must sit for talks and resume a meaningful negotiation.
Afghan government has ordered the country's Ministry of Awqaf and Hajj to open the doors of all mosques in government-controlled areas for displaced families, and that the government is going to fully support them under close cooperation with the international humanitarian agencies. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Meet Nura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyat Allah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Nura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Nura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Nura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
Well, Nura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus. It stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Nura developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Nura will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine, dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region. And this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place. Experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they're described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang. The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since him deserves it abundant praise. I seek refuge in him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. After just about 20 years since the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan by the United States, the Taliban have overthrown the Washington-supported Afghan government. President Ashraf Ghani has left the country, and the United States and some other Western nations are scrambling to get their nationals out of Afghanistan. We will look at Afghanistan on the Spotlight, the goals of the Americans for originally going into Afghanistan and what was really accomplished and what may lie ahead for Afghanistan under the Taliban. I'd like to start off this conversation in Kabul itself with Amin Alami. Amin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, we'll start off with please filling us in on the latest situation on the ground there.
Well, Marzia, Afghanistan has entered a new chapter, and the Taliban are currently in full control of the Afghan capital, Kabul. Just a few minutes ago, a Taliban member appeared on the Afghan national TV. He assured the residents of Kabul of their safety and asked them to resume their daily life. In the meantime, the roads and the streets inside the capital, Kabul, are empty, and the Taliban has also asked the residents of capital to honor a night curfew just tonight. In the meantime, the residents of Kabul seems to be worried about what has happened, because it happened during 6 or 7 hours on Sunday. They are worried, they are concerned, because they are facing a change of power, a change of regime now here. They are facing the Taliban, despite the Taliban has already emphasized that no one will be harmed by their members. Even they assured the governmental employees and the members of Afghanistan's defense and security and defense forces and other employees of the Afghan government to be safe. The Taliban are also stressing that the foreign embassies, international aid agencies, NGOs, and international and media workers are allowed to work here. But it will be very important to realize that the Afghan president was named as the former Afghan president by Abdullah Abdullah. He said that the former Afghan president has left Afghanistan and its people behind irresponsibly. In the meantime, another prominent political leader and former Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, also shared a video message showing him and three of his children who emphasized that I'm in Afghanistan, I'm in Kabul, and I'll stay along with my family alongside the people of Afghanistan here. But another important fact is that the residents of Kabul are even seeking shelter abroad, because they think that at least there would be no enough atmosphere or place to work for most of the residents here who were working with international agencies or many other local or regional agencies who cannot work under the Taliban.
You talked about that last part. I just want to touch on that, because you said a lot of Afghans, those who can, are trying to seek to go outside of the country. What's the overall situation right now at the airport? I mean, we're hearing conflicting reports.
Well, as I mentioned, a Taliban member who appeared on the Afghan national TV also said that the entire capital Kabul is under the control of the Afghan government. He said that Arg and Shashtarag, was known as a green zone of Kabul and was known as a diplomatic area, are also under the control of the Taliban. But it is not, we are not being informed either the Kabul International Airport is completely under the control of Taliban or not, because we are hearing and we are seeing that some helicopters are flying over Kabul, over diplomatic area of Kabul.
Okay, stay with us. Amin, thank you so much for that update. I'd like to welcome our other guests to the program. Political analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And a co-founder of American Peace Movement Code Bank, Madia Benjamin out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us on the Spotlight. Well, let's start it off in Brussels. And Elijah, I mean, very fast-moving, fluid situations taking place in Afghanistan. Now, all American forces were supposed to have been withdrawn by August the 31st, even before the official end of Washington, Afghanistan. Now, the Taliban have taken control of the country. This happened so quickly. Your assessment of all of this, when Afghan forces had been trained by the U.S. and its Western allies for 20 years, and they have the best equipment, what happened in your perspective?
Thank you for having me. Actually, I think it was a very big surprise to the Americans. That is a strong indication of the failure of the intelligence services. We heard President Joe Biden saying just a few hours ago, 24 hours ago, that it is no way Taliban will come into the city, that the U.S. forces trained 300,000 Afghan troops, and they are fully equipped with a strong air force. And we saw all this collapsing within hours, and then by the time we hear the first news, then something else is happening, and then we hear that Taliban is not going into the city, and then we see the Taliban inside the presidential palace. I think this move of Taliban surprised everybody in the international community, and NATO in Brussels was really shocked. The people I spoke to, they did not expect this fast move of Taliban and the collapse of the Afghan army and the institution, and the and how the president of Afghanistan escaped and ran away with his family and his aide and his vice outside this the country, and to seek refuge somewhere else, that he abandoned his country. So all that, we understand that the Americans are really unreliable. Wherever they go into any country, they've trained the Iraqi army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army collapsed in 2 days. And they've trained the Afghan army in for 20 years, 300,000, and this army collapsed in 1 week. I mean, this is really a record to what the Americans are capable of, and a clear indication of their failure and how they really failed to earn hearts and minds of the population, and how their training is consisting in how to use of weapons, but they don't give any motivation to the people of the region to feel how they need to defend their country or how to look after their country. They want people to be loyal to the Americans, and now the Americans have left, and then what? So this is what happened to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The army is really completely scattered with no orders to be given and nowhere to go. They don't know what to do, so they allowed Taliban to go into the capital and control it.
Well, what about that, Madia? I mean, did Washington, because Washington itself could not establish security on the ground in Afghanistan, did it anticipate that the Afghan military could do it? And obviously, they have assessed the Afghan military in these 2 decades. If they were going to withdraw, which was definitely needed, most people in the region would say that. Why was it done so haphazardly?
I think they had terrible intelligence. The fact that Biden just recently said that the Afghan army was strong, the fact that the spokesperson for the Pentagon, John Kirby, just 2 days ago said that there was no imminent threat to Kabul, is really a black eye on 20 years of black eyes that the U.S. has been getting. To do this withdrawal in such a terrible fashion, where they took the troops out and then announced that they were bringing troops back in, and now they're announcing even more troops going back in to evacuate the Americans who are there, just makes absolutely no sense and shows how miserable the U.S. military, the U.S. intelligence, the U.S. generals, the entire operation has been for 20 years. Unfortunately, the victims are the Afghan people, who are very worried right now about what the future will bring, how the Taliban will govern. They're worried about will the Taliban really stick to their assurances that there will not be revenge killings? Who knows? But it is a tragic departure from a war that should never have happened in the first place.
Well, Elijah, I mean, there's been little resistance, as you pointed out, by Afghan forces, the Taliban, and we have seen it's been very quickly that the Taliban have taken over the whole country now. But what does that say in general to you? Some say that it's a sign of frustration on the part of the people and the military of the status quo, the former Afghan government, and not willing to risk their lives anymore to actually support this government. How do you see it, Elijah?
Well, when we have President Biden saying there are only 70,000 Taliban, and 70,000 managed to occupy a country that is twice the size of the United Kingdom, That is a lot of telling us. It tells us that the population, most of the population, either fed up of the American presence and the pro-American ruling, or they are in support of Taliban, or both. When we see the Taliban walking into the provinces, being able to occupy seven provinces in a few days, this is really incredible. They're walking in without fight. They walk into the capital, Kabul, without fighting. It means that the population want the departure of the Americans and want the departure of the government that is pro-American. Now, we have to wait and see if Taliban is coming with a new face or a new style. We hear in the first hours of their presence at the presidential palace that they want everybody to be involved in the government. They don't try to provoke diplomatic mission. So maybe Taliban that we knew 20 years ago or in 1996 when they declared the first emirate is different from the Taliban that is today. And I think their behavior with the population and the killing that President Obama and Bush before him using the drone by indiscriminating killing the population while trying to hunt down Al-Qaeda and other Taliban operatives, that helped the Taliban to earn the support of the population and to enter so many cities in such a record time.
What about that, Medea? I mean, that's actually fascinating what Elijah said, that the U.S. went in saying one thing, but the reality on the ground actually made people support the Taliban more than they had before because of the U.S. and its Western allies' crimes that was basically continuous in their country.
That's right. There are so many Afghan civilians that have been killed by the U.S. and the NATO forces. And then on top of that, while we in the United States have been constantly hearing about the corruption of the Afghan government, I think inside Afghanistan, you would see that the most corrupt element has been the U.S., whether it's the U.S. military or other aspects of the U.S. government that have been injecting billions and billions of dollars into the country to make individuals wealthy, both in the United States, the contractors, as well as individuals inside of Afghanistan. It's interesting that the Taliban have been showing images of Dostum's palace. It reminds you of Saddam Hussein's palace when the U.S. went in, but showing the enrichment of those who are in control now is something I think that most Afghans understood, that this war was big business and that it was the puppet government of the United States and the West that were the ones that were really enriching themselves. And it made people inside Afghanistan very angry. And we hope that we can make that clear to the American public so that there is some kind of accountability in the United States for the literally trillions of dollars that has been sent on this colossal failure.
Well, Elijah, why didn't the U.S. initiate nation building during this 20 years that they were there? Or was the goal always just to create another dependent client state, not one which could be independent and obviously not one could one which could hold its own?
Absolutely. What the Americans are trying in the Middle East and West Asia, we see what they've done in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, because the war in Yemen is not a Saudi war, it's an American war. And we see what they've done in Afghanistan and how they're trying to force Lebanon into a failed state and all the sanctions on Iran. We see only sanction and punishment that the American administration, one after the other, Republican or Democrats, are exerting exactly the same line of policy in this part of the world that is called West Asia. And they're not trying to construct anything. They're not trying to export technology or knowledge or self-governance. They're trying to submit people and to force them into their own hegemony. This is what many people in West Asia are rejecting, and this is why they're fighting the Americans, because they can see the example the Americans are setting, what your guest said rightly. It's, they support corruption, they support corrupted government. We see that in Iraq, we see that now in Afghanistan, and they spend trillions of dollars only on supporting corruption and corrupted governments that are pro-US only to say that we have some kind of control. Well, look, they just say we're going to withdraw and the whole country collapse again. What's the benefit on being in an area where it's going to fall immediately after the departure of the American, or just announcing a departure? This is a total failure, not only of the intelligence services, but also of the way any and every U.S. administration is trying to run the world and trying to occupy other countries. It is time for the U.S. to change its policy and allow the people of West Asia to decide its own fate.
Well, Madea, security seems to be the biggest goal of the Afghan people. Do you think that the Taliban can actually establish security in this country? Your assessment of that side of things?
Well, I have only seen examples of when they've gone into some of the villages and have been welcomed because they do bring security. We don't know what it will be like when they control the whole country. We don't know if security means very, very harsh implementation of an extremist kind of Sharia law, because there are different kinds of security. But we do see that in some of the areas where they're already governing, which has been actually quite a large swath of Afghanistan, especially in the rural areas, that there are many places where there is more security since the Taliban have arrived.
And Elijah, your perspective, possible scenarios for future Afghanistan under Taliban rule?
I think Taliban is going to be a new Taliban that is going to offer a different way to behave with the countries of the region and with its own population. The mere fact that they are entering the capital, Kabul, without fighting, and other cities without fighting, that tells us a lot. It tells us that the Taliban are not trying to kill as many people as they can, as they used to do in the past, but they are trying to offer another perspective of how Afghani can rule their own country. And this is why they are calling everybody to join the government. And this is the right thing, because Taliban on its own can never rule Afghanistan. Taliban needs all the other party and all the other ethnic group to join in one government and in one ruling. And by the fact that they are protecting the diplomatic missions, and Russia announced that it's not evacuating, unlike NATO, it means that the diplomatic mission feels safer with the presence of this Taliban, that we saw how it's negotiating in Qatar and how it's talking to other countries, have been in Iran, they're talking to different countries around the world, and they're not completely isolated as they used to be.
Okay, Madea, just 1 minute we have left. I mean, as Americans escape from Kabul now, it reminds us of the Saigon evacuation. How badly do you see the U.S.'s defeat there? And how does this affect the U.S. itself?
Well, it's a terrible blight on the United States after 20 years, but I am hoping that just like after the defeat in Vietnam, where there was what's called Vietnam syndrome, the public aversion to getting involved in overseas conflicts, that we will now have an Afghanistan syndrome where the U.S. public says we do not want our government and our military invading and occupying other countries. Perhaps that's the only silver lining in this whole colossal failure.
Okay, and we can hope. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us on this spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels, and co-founder of American Peace Movement Code Pink, Madea Benjamin, out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. the limelight.
The world's leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights. According to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. Insurance Giants, Worsening Climate Crisis, Biodiversity Loss, and Human Rights Violations. Stay tuned for more. Leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights, according to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog. In what it described as the first comprehensive assessment of insurers' environmental, social, and corporate governance, ESG credentials, ShareAction analyzed and ranked how 70 of the world's biggest insurance companies, together responsible for assets totaling $22 trillion, are approaching responsible investment governance, the climate emergency, biodiversity loss, and human rights. In contrast to their reputation as risk experts who assesses, manages, and help reduce social and environmental risks, the majority of large insurers fail to adequately address systematic risks such as climate change and biodiversity loss, wrote the authors of the report, which was based on company surveys and an examination of publicly available data. Almost half of insurers, that is about 46%, received an E, the lowest grade, while another 17% received a D rating. Just 16% demonstrated a relatively strong performance that merited a rating of B or higher. Yet, even the leading insurer scored just over 50% of the available points, the report said. On average, insurers scored only 12% of all available points. We hope this unprecedented overview of the industry offers a wake-up call to insurers, report co-author Felix Nagarwala said in a statement. These ratings must improve and quickly if the industry hopes to survive a future built on renewables and equity, not fossil fuels and slave labor. No insurer received an AA or AAA rating, although five European companies received an A grade. The performance of U.S. insurers, meanwhile, was remarkably poor. ShareAction gave an E to 75% of U.S. insurance companies, compared with 52% in Asia and 22% in Europe. Of the 12 lowest-ranked insurers with a property and casualty business, half were U.S. insurance giants Nationwide, AIG, Allstate, Genworth Financial, Protective Life, and Travelers that scored 5% or lower on issues of governance, climate, biodiversity, and human rights. Furthermore, of the 15 lowest-ranked life and health insurers, which scored 3% or lower on the four categories being evaluated, 9 were U.S. companies. RiverSource, Northwestern Mutual, Talcott Resolution, Pacific Life, Lincoln Financial Group, Protective Life, Mass Mutual, Brighthouse Financial, and Aflac. the U.S. insurance industry is buying its head in the sand as the rest of the world races to embrace a greener, cleaner, and more equitable future, said Nagarala. Despite the sector's expertise in identifying, forecasting, and managing risk, it continues to support companies responsible for climate change, including those engaged in coal, tar, sands, and Arctic oil and gas. These aggregated results from this study showed that while the world's top insurers received an average score of 27% on the topic of governance, they performed even worse on the climate crisis, 11%, human rights, 8%, and biodiversity, about 3%. By continuing to underwrite and invest in fossil fuel extraction and disregard the well-being of working people, by neglecting dangerous workplace conditions, gender and racial discrimination, child and forced labor in supply chains, and forced displacement of communities, insurance companies, particularly U.S. ones, are exacerbating environmental and social crises even more than other actors in the financial sector. The stronger ESG policies and practices, the report said. Despite the fact that insurers make up 12 of the 26 members of the United Nations convened Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance, and despite plans for a Net Zero Insurance Alliance, only 13% of assessed insurers have made net zero commitments for investments, and just 3% have a net zero policy for underwriting activities, according to ShareAction. Insurers are better placed than any other type of private financial institution to exert pressure on the coal industry, as coal projects cannot be financed, built, or operated without insurance coverage, the report noted. But U.S. providers are largely failing to use this influence. In fact, of the 7 assessed U.S. insurance companies with a property and casualty business, Liberty Mutual is the only one with a policy that restricts underwriting for coal projects, ShareAction pointed out. By contrast, 54% of non-U.S. insurers impose restrictions on underwriting for coal projects. However, ShareAction said that none of the 70 companies receiving scrutiny has placed limits on underwriting for gas and oil, despite a 2018 warning from UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that building new fossil fuel projects and keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius are incompatible. The analysis of the global insurance industry comes on the heels of a bombshell report published last week by the International Energy Agency, in which the relatively conservative institution made clear that remaining fossil fuels must stay in the ground if the world is to avert the most catastrophic effects of the climate emergency. Regarding biodiversity loss, the vast majority of assessed insurers have not yet developed an approach to managing nature-related risks to their portfolios and show little understanding of how their investment and underwriting activities are driving or may be affected by the biodiversity crisis, the report noted. Moreover, nearly three-quarters of assessed insurance companies, that is about 73%, do not have an investment policy covering human and labor rights, ShareAction found. Only 13% of assessed insurers have made a commitment not to invest in companies that are knowingly in breach of human and labor rights, showing that the industry is willing to turn a blind eye to direct and deliberate corporate human rights violations, the authors wrote. North American insurers are the worst offenders. Not a single one of the 24 insurers from the U.S. or Canada has a policy. Underscoring the need for the insurance industry to evolve, the report noted that only one of the 7 assessed U.S. insurers with a property and casualty business has carried out climate scenario analysis to identify long-term risks to their portfolios, compared with 46% of non-U.S. peers share action, called that particularly alarming in the context of recent wildfires in the U.S., which in California in 2020 alone caused insured losses of an estimated $8 billion.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.